Chapter 2. Of all the ships in the 28th expedition, the Pride of the Emperor was the most magnificent. Its armoured length inlaid with gold and armoured plates the colour of rich wine. It orbited the sapphire-blue world of Laren like the regal flagship of some ancient king, surrounded by an entourage of escorts, battleships, transports, supply vessels, and army mass conveyors. The shipwrights of Jupiter had laid its keel 160 years ago, the design and creation overseen by the fabricator general of Mars himself, and its every component crafted by hand to unimaginably exacting specifications. The construction process had taken twice as long as any other vessel of comparable displacement, but such was only to be expected for the flagship of the Primarch of the Third Legion, the Emperor's Children. The formation of 28th Expedition was a thing of martial beauty, perfectly anchored above Laren in a textbook pattern of patrol and compliance that ensured nothing hostile could reach or leave the planet without being intercepted by the raptores of the Imperial fleet. The vessels of the lair that had proven so deadly to the expedition's scout fleet were now wreckage, drifting around the rings of the system's sixth planet, destroyed by the precise use of overwhelming force and Fulgrim's mastery of naval warfare. Though the world below was known as Laren, its official designation was 28-3, being the third world the 28th Expedition had brought to compliance. Though such an appellation was somewhat premature, given the ferocity of the opening battle, attesting to its non-compliance, its usage was considered appropriate, since compliance was deemed a certainty. The Andronius and Fulgrim's Virtue, liveried in the purple and gold of the Emperor's Children, stood sentinel over the Primarch's flagship, each with an exemplary legacy of victory behind them. Flocks of raptores darted back and forth as they escorted the great and the good of the 28th Expedition to the Pride of the Emperor, for with the lair fleet eliminated, the Primarch was to unveil his plans to prosecute the war. First Captain Julius Caseron was a man not used to conflicting emotions, which made his current situation deeply uncomfortable. Dressed in the triumphal purple of his toga picta and the martial red of his lacerna cloak, he cut an imposing figure as he marched swiftly to the Heliopolis, followed by his equerry Lycaon, and a retinue of bearers who carried his helmet, sword, and trailing cloak. A pendant of fiery amber hung around his neck and nestled between the carved pectorals of his golden breastplate. Nothing of his discomfort showed on his patrician features, for to display such emotion would suggest that he doubted the course his Primarch had set, and that was unthinkable. They marched along a wide processional way with pale walls of cool marble and towering onyx columns, their surfaces inlaid with gold lettering that spoke of battles won and glories gained during the Great Crusade. The Pride of the Emperor was to be Fulgrim's legacy to the future, and its walls bore the history of the Imperium carved into its very bones. Statues of the Legion's heroes lined the processional way, and gilt-framed artworks commissioned from the expedition's remembrances brought some much-needed colour to the cold space. "Are we in a hurry?" asked Lycaon, his armour shining and polished, though much less ostentatious than that of the first captain. "I thought the Lord Fulgrim said he would await your arrival before presenting his course to the expedition." "He did," snapped Julius, though he quickened his pace, much to the consternation of his bearers. "But if we are to do what he demands, then the sooner I am down on 28-3, the better. A month, Lycaon. He wants Laren compliant in a month." "The men are ready," promised Lycaon. "We can do it." "I don't doubt we can do it, Lycaon, but the butcher's bill will be high, perhaps too high. The Stormbirds are prepped on their launch rails, and we await only your word to unleash them on the lair."
"I know," nodded Julius, "but we must await the Primarch's order to launch."
"Even though Captain Demeter's spear-tip has already launched?" asked Lycaon as they passed Emperor's Children armed with golden pilum spears at regular intervals along the triumphal way.
Though they stood as immobile as the statues, the fierce potential for violence that beat within the breast of every Astartes warrior was evident in each of them. Even so, agreed Julius, it would be impolitic to begin the campaign proper without consulting the other officers of the expedition, so the spear tip will be presented as reconnaissance in force, rather than as the opening strike of a campaign. Lycaon shrugged and shook his head. What do we care for the feelings of the expedition? The Primarch commands, and they are his to order as he sees fit. Such is only right and proper. Though he agreed with Lycaon, Julius didn't answer, chafing at not leading the warriors on the planet below. He had listened to the initial vox reports of Solomon and Marius, who were even now involved in heavy fighting to secure the floating landmass known as Atoll 19, with growing anger as the casualty reports flooded in. But his Primarch had ordered his presence at the Council of War that would announce the manner in which the 28th Expedition would make war upon this alien species, and such orders were not to be denied. Julius already knew what the Lord Fulgrim was to present to the senior commanders of the fleet, and the audacity and scale of it still took his breath away. You didn't need to be first captain of the Emperor's children to know what their reaction would be. Enough talking, Lycaon. We're here, he said, as he saw the great Phoenix Gate before them, a towering bronze portal that depicted the Emperor symbolically presenting Fulgrim with the Imperial Eagle. The Eagle was the Emperor's own symbol, and he had commanded that Fulgrim's legion alone bear it upon their armour as a mark of the regard in which they were held. The honour done to the Emperor's children was immeasurable. As he saw the gate, Julius felt fierce pride swell within his breast, and he reached up to touch the carved eagle on his armour. More guards stood before the Phoenix Gate, and they bowed deeply as he approached, clashing their spears into the ground as the great leaves of bronze smoothly parted before him, a slice of white light and the hubbub of voices drifting through from beyond. He nodded respectfully to the warriors at the gate, and pass through into the Heliopolis. Solomon spun his bolter to face the creature that slashed through the air towards him, its claws outstretched to tear him in two. His finger squeezed the trigger, and a hail of bolts spat from the barrel of his gun. Sparks and yellow blood spattered his purple and gold armour as the creature burst apart and collapsed in a torn heap beside him. More followed it, and soon the plaza was alive with whipping, sinuous bodies and struggling Astartes. In appearance, each layer could be wildly diverse, their bioforms differing between war zones, and apparently engineered for each particular theatre of war. In his short time on the oceanic world of Laren, Solomon had seen winged, aquatic, and all manner of variations on the basic layer form. Whether they were divergent strands of genetic mutation or deliberately engineered warrior creatures, Solomon didn't know, nor did he care. These particular beasts were tall, sinuous monsters, with the snake-like lower body common to all lair, and muscular thoraxes sheathed in silver armour from which sprouted two pairs of limbs. The upper arms each bore long, lightning-wreathed blades, their elegant forms curved like scimitars, while the lower arms each wielded crackling gauntlets that fired the lethal green energy bolts. Their heads were insect-like and bulbous, with glossy, multifaceted eyes and jutting mandibles that produced a grating screech when the lair attacked. Solomon spun on the spot, firing his bolter at every slithering body that emerged from the alien structures carved from the hard coral of the atoll. The veterans who accompanied him formed a curving line with him at its centre, each warrior moving smoothly into his allotted place to push the lair back towards the crackling plume of energy in the middle of the plaza with every marching step they took. Bolter rounds filled the air, and explosions sent chunks of coral flying as the unstoppable advance of the Emperor's children pushed deeper into the screaming ruins of the floating city. With no intersuit vox, Solomon had no idea how Cafan or Thelonious were doing, but trusted their expertise and courage to see them through. Solomon had personally approved both their commands, and whatever fate befell them, was his responsibility. Green fire washed from a previously unseen burrow entrance, and a trio of Astarte's warriors went down, their armour and flesh disintegrating beneath the electrochemical energies. "Enemy to the flank!" shouted Solomon, and his warriors reacted with smooth precision to meet the threat. As the lair emerged from their hiding place, they were met by disciplined volleys of bolter fire, the first Emperor's children to meet the threat, shifting position to allow their comrades to fire while they reloaded. Solomon watched with pride as they fought with a flawless martial discipline unmatched by any other legion. The berserk rages of Russ's wolves, or the wild showmanship of the Khan's riders, were not the way of the Emperor's children. Fulgrim's legion fought with the cold, clinical application of perfect force and discipline. A huge explosion mushroomed skyward from Solomon's right, and he heard the crash of falling coral as a conch tower collapsed in a billowing cloud of dust and fire, its damnable horns silenced as it smashed to pieces. The Emperor's children had pushed some 40 meters into the plaza, their curving line of advance carrying them into the centre of its crater and rubble-strewn openness. The plume of energy was close enough for him to feel its heat, and as he gave the order to surround it, the lair renewed their assault, their writhing bodies slipping around the ruins of their homes with unnatural speed. Whipping bolts of green light and bolter rounds crisscrossed the plaza, flaring explosions rippling the air as the occasional pair of shots impacted on one another. A boiling tide of aliens slid towards the Emperor's children, their snake-like lower bodies powering them across the uneven ground with unnatural speed, and Solomon knew that the time for guns was over. He placed his bolter on the ground with reverent care and drew his chain blade from its sheath across his back. Like his bolter, he had extensively modified his sword in the pride of the Emperor's armories under the stern gaze of Marius Verosian. The blade and grip of the weapon had been lengthened to increase his reach and to allow him to wield the blade two-handed. The quillons were fashioned in the form of upswept wings, and the pommel bore a majestic eagle's head. He thumbed the activation stud and shouted, "Unsheath!" 100 blades glittered in the sunlight as the circle of Emperor's children drew their swords in one smooth motion. The lair hit the Emperor's children in a blur of silver armour and crackling blades, the Astartes stepping in to meet their enemies head to head. Mars-forged steel met alien blades in a clash of fire that echoed throughout the city. Solomon ducked a blow aimed at his head and spun inside the stroke of the alien's second blade, driving his sword into the gap between his foe's armoured thorax and lower body. The teeth of his blade ground on its thick spine, but he forced the blade onwards, dropping the creature into 2 flopping halves. His warriors fought with calm serenity, confident in their superiority and knowing that their leader was among them. Solomon tore his blade free from the alien he had killed and stepped onwards, his warriors following his example and grimly fighting with killing strokes. The first warning of something amiss was when a violent tremor shook the ground with a rumbling vibration. Then suddenly the world shifted as the ground violently canted to the side. Solomon was pitched to the ground, rolling on the slanted plaza and tumbling into one of the many deep craters that dotted the battlefield. He quickly righted himself and scanned his immediate area for threats, but could see nothing, hearing the sound of battle from above him and gunfire closing on the plaza from either side. If the suspicions of the Mechanicum were correct, and the energy coils were what kept the atolls afloat in the sky, it seemed likely that one or more elsewhere on the atoll must have been destroyed. Solomon rolled to his feet and sheathed his sword as he began clambering up the rocky slopes of the crater. As he neared the top, he felt the hairs on the back of his neck stand to attention and looked up in time to see the silhouette of a lair warrior over the lip of the crater. He reached for his sword, but the lair was on him before he could draw the weapon. Though Julius Caesaron had stood in the Heliopolis many hundreds of times, its beauty and majesty still had the power to render him speechless, with its towering walls of pale stone and rank upon rank of marble statues on golden plinths that supported the vast domed room. Intricate mosaics, too high to make out the details, filled the coffers of the dome, and long silk banners of purple and gold hung between fluted pilasters of green marble. A lustrous beam of focused starlight shone down from the centre of the dome, reflecting dazzlingly from the black terrazzo floor of the Heliopolis. Marble and quartz chips laid into the mortar and ground to a polished sheen turned the floor into a glittering dark mirror that shone like the heavens beyond. Dust motes danced in the brightness, and the smoky aroma of scented oils filled the air. Rows of marble benches ran around the circumference of Fulgrim's council chamber, rising in stepped tiers towards the walls in serried ranks, enough to seat 2,000 men, though barely a quarter of that number were present for this council of war. A chair of polished black marble sat in the centre of the pillar of starlight, and it was from here that Lord Fulgrim heard the petitions of his warriors and granted audiences. Though the Primarch had not yet graced this assemblage with his arrival, the empty chair was a potent presence in the chamber. Julius saw officers drawn from all the military arms of the 28th Expedition seated in the marble benches, and moved to take his place on the bench nearest the floor, nodding to men whose faces he knew, and noticing wary glances at his red lacerna cloak. Those who had served with the Emperor's children for any length of time knew that the wearing of such a cloak signified a warrior about to go into battle. Julius ignored their stares and retrieved his sword and helmet from his bearers before taking his seat. He cast his eyes around the chamber, seeing silver and scarlet officers of the Imperial Army filling the lower tiers of the Heliopolis, their closeness to the floor indicative of their higher ranks. Lord Commander Fyle sat at the centre of a gaggle of flunkies and aides. He was a stern man with a horribly scarred face, augmented with a steel plate that obscured the left side of his head. Julius had never spoken to the man, but knew him by reputation, a skilled general, a blunt speaker, and a ruthless, unforgiving soldier. Behind the officers of the army, occupying the mid-level of seating, were the adepts of the Mechanicum, looking uncomfortable in the bright light of the Heliopolis. Their hooded robes hid much of their features, and Julius could not remember if he had ever seen one with his hood down. He shook his head at the foolish veils of secrecy and ritual they surrounded themselves with. Alongside the Mechanicum were the Remembrancers, earnest men and women in beige robes that scrawled in battered notepads and data slates or sketched on cartridge paper with charcoals. The greatest artists, writers and poets of the Imperium had spread through the expedition fleets in their thousands to document the monumental achievements of the Great Crusade, meeting varying degrees of welcome. Precious few of the legions appreciated their efforts, but Fulgrim had declared their presence to be a great boon, and had granted them unprecedented access to his most intimate and guarded ceremonies. Following his gaze, Lycaon spat. Remembrances! What purpose do scriveners and their ilk serve at a council of war? Look, one of them has even brought an easel. Julius smiled and said, "Perhaps he is attempting to capture the glory of the Heliopolis for future generations, my friend." "Russ has the truth of it," said Lycaon. "We are warriors, not subjects for poetry or portraits." "The pursuit of perfection extends beyond the martial disciplines, Lycaon. It encompasses fine arts, literary works and music. Only recently I was privileged to hear Bekwa Kinska's recital, and my heart soared to hear such sweet music." "You've been reading poetry again, haven't you?" asked Lycaon, shaking his head. "When I have the chance, I delve into one of Ignace Carcassi's imperial cantos," admitted Julius. "You should try it sometime. A little culture would be no bad thing for you." Fulgrim himself has a sculpture in his chambers that he commissioned from Ostian Delafort, and it is said that Eidolon has a landscape of Chemos painted by Kilan Roger hanging above his bed.
Never! Eidolon!
So they say, nodded Julius.
Who'd have thought it, mused Lycaon.
Anyway, I'll stick to achieving perfection in war if it's all the same to you.
Your loss, said Julius, as the benches in the upper reaches of the Heliopolis filled with people. The scribes, notaries, and functionaries who serve those nearer the centre of power.
Big turnout, noted Lycaon.
The Primarch is going to speak, said Julius. That always brings the adorers out.
As though speaking his name was the key to summoning him, the Phoenix Gate opened and the Primarch of the Third Legion entered the Heliopolis. Fulgrim was flanked by his senior Lord Commanders, and the assembled warriors, adepts and scribes immediately rose to their feet and bowed their heads in wonder at the magnificent, perfect warrior before them. Julius rose with them, his earlier discomfort washed away in the rush of excitement at seeing his beloved Primarch once again. A swell of rippling applause and cries of Phoenician filled the Heliopolis, a roaring gesture of affirmation that only halted when Fulgrim raised his palms to quiet his reverent followers. The Primarch wore a long flowing toga of pale cream, and the dark iron hilt of his sword, Fireblade, was visible at his hip, the blade itself sheathed in a scabbard of gleaming purple leather. The flaring wings of an eagle were embroidered in gold thread across his chest, and a slender band of lapis lazuli kept his silver hair from his face. Two of the Legion's greatest warriors, Lord Commander Vespasian and Lord Commander Eidolon, came in behind the Primarch. Both warriors were dressed in plain white togas, unadorned, save for a small eagle motif over the right breast. Their stern, martial bearing was an inspiration for Julius, who held himself a little straighter at their presence. Eidolon looked unimpressed at the gathered warriors, while Vespasian's humours were unreadable behind his flawless classical features. Both Lord Commanders were armed, Vespasian's sword held sheathed at his side, and Eidolon's hammer carried upon his shoulder. Julius could feel the tension in the air as the expedition awaited Fulgrim's words. "My friends," began Fulgrim, taking his seat before the assembled warriors, his pale skin radiant in the glow from above. "It gladdens my heart to see you gathered so. It has been too long since last we made war, but what a chance we have now to remedy that." Though he knew what was coming, Julius felt an unreasoning excitement build within him and saw that the normally sardonic Lycaon smiled broadly when he heard the Primarch speak. "We orbit the world of a fearsome species that calls itself the Lair," continued Fulgrim, his voice having lost the chthonic harshness he had picked up while the Emperor's children had fought alongside the War Master's lunar wolves. The cultured accent of old Terra again flavoured every syllable, and Julius found himself beguiled by the timbre and cadence of the Primarch's words.
"And such a world it is, one that the honoured representatives from the Mechanicum tell me would be of immeasurable value to the crusade of the Emperor, he who is beloved by all."
"Beloved by all," echoed the chamber.
Fulgrim nodded and said, "Though a world such as this would be of immense value to us, its alien inhabitants do not wish to share what blind fortune has blessed them with. They refuse to see the manifest destiny that guides us through the stars and have made it abundantly clear that they hold us in nothing but contempt. Our peaceable advances have been rebuffed with violence, and honour demands we answer in kind."
Angry shouts of threatened violence filled the Heliopolis. Fulgrim smiled, clasping his hands to his chest in thanks for their devotion. As the cheering and shouts died away, Julius saw Lord Commander File stand and bow deeply to the Primarch.
"If I may," ventured the soldier, his voice deep and laden with experience, Of course, Thaddeus. You are my most favoured ally, said Fulgrim. And Fyle's stern mask twitched in pleasure at being addressed by his first name. Julius smiled as he remembered the skill with which Fulgrim flattered those he spoke to, knowing full well that he was soon to blindside Fyle with hard facts and uncomfortable truths.
Thank you, my lord, began Fyle, placing his gnarled hands on the wall that separated him from the dark floor of the Heliopolis. As Thaddeus Fyle spoke, microscopic motes of crystal floating in the column of light focused on the army commander, wreathing him in a diffuse glow.
"Perhaps you can enlighten me as to something?"
Fulgrim smiled, and his dark eyes were alive with mirth.
"I shall endeavour to bring illumination to your ignorance."
Fyle bristled at the implied insult, but pressed on.
"You have called us here for a council of war, regarding what is to be done with 28-3, yes?"
"Indeed I have," replied Fulgrim, "for I could not conceive of undertaking such a decision without your counsel."
"Then why have you already sent warriors to the planet's surface?" asked Fyle with impressive force of will.
Most mortals were rendered imbecilic simply by standing in the presence of a Primarch, but Thaddeus Fyle spoke as though to a member of his own staff, and Julius felt his collar rise at such boorish behaviour.
"I heard word that the Council of Terror had decided that subjugating the lair would cost too many lives and would take too long. 10 years was the figure I heard," continued Fyle without pause. "Wasn't there even talk of making them a protectorate of the Imperium?"
Julius saw the faint but unmistakable signs of Fulgrim's annoyance at being so questioned, though he must surely have known that virtually the entire expedition was aware of the assault on Atoll 19 and that he would face such interrogation. Such was the price of cultivating openness within the expedition, Julius realized.
"There was indeed such talk," said Fulgrim, "but it was ill-founded and singularly failed to appreciate the value of this planet to the Imperium. The attack underway is an attempt to gather a more thorough appreciation of the war capability of the lair."
"Surely the destruction of our scout ships demonstrated that amply, my lord," said Fyle. "It seems to me that you already have your course set on war without consulting us."
"And what of it, Lord Commander?"
asked Fulgrim, his eyes flashing with dangerous anger.
"Would you back down from the effrontery of a Xenos species? Would you have me compromise my honour by meekly avoiding this fight because it might be dangerous?"
Lord Commander Fyle blanched at Fulgrim's tone, realising that he had pushed too far, and said,
"No, my lord, my forces are at your disposal, as always."
Fulgrim's features settled from annoyance to conciliation in a moment, and Julius knew that his outburst had been carefully orchestrated to manipulate Fyle into ceasing his questions. Fulgrim had already drawn up his perfect plans for war, and was not about to be dissuaded from his course by the doubts of mortals.
"My thanks, Lord Commander," said Fulgrim, "and I apologise for my abruptness. You are right to ask such things, for it is said that a man's character can be judged by his questions rather than by his answers."
"There's no need to apologise to me," protested Fyle,
uncomfortable at the suggestion he had angered the Primarch.
"I spoke out of turn."
Fulgrim inclined his head in the direction of the Lord Commander, accepting his apology, and said,
"You are gracious, Thaddeus, and the matter is already forgotten. But we are here to discuss matters of war, are we not? I have devised a campaign that will see Laren delivered to us, and while I appreciate the counsel you all give me, this is the kind of war for which the Astartes were forged. I will outline its particulars to you in a moment, but as time is critical, I hope you will forgive me if I unleash my war dogs first."
The Primarch turned his gaze towards him, and despite himself, Julius felt his pulse quicken as Fulgrim's inky black eyes bored into him. He knew what question would be asked, and only hoped his men could deliver on what Fulgrim was to demand of them.
"First Captain Kayseron, are your warriors ready to take the Imperial truth to 28-3?
Julius stood to attention, feeling the light from the dome's room bathe him in radiance.
"I swear by the fire, they are, my lord.
We await only your word.
Then the word is given, Captain Kayseran, said Fulgrim, casting off his robes to reveal his magnificently polished battle plate. In 1 month's time, the eagle will rule Laren.
The lair's arms tore at Solomon's armour, dragging great gouges from its immaculate surfaces, the talons tearing through the gold eagle on his breastplate. The two warriors fell to the base of the crater as the ground shifted again, and Solomon found himself pinned beneath the weight of the creature. Its mandibles opened wide and it screeched deafeningly in his face, spraying him with hot spittle and mucus. Solomon shook his vision clear and punched upwards, his fist cracking bone beneath the ruddy red flesh of the alien warrior. It screeched once more, and a burst of green light exploded from its fists as it stabbed one of its lower arms towards him. He rolled aside as the silver gauntlet sheared through the rock as though it were no more solid than sand. Solomon scrambled away from the creature, his back against the walls of the crater. The lair howled, the power of its scream a physical force that sent Solomon staggering backwards, his ears ringing and his vision blurred. He tried to draw his sword, but the lair was on him again before the weapon was halfway from its sheath. The combatants crashed to the ground in a maelstrom of thrashing armoured limbs and segmented claws. The horrific eyes of the lair reflected his contorted face, and he felt his anger and frustration rise at the thought of being trapped down in this crater while his men fought on above without him. Hot pain lanced into his side as the lair scored its glowing green weapon across his flank, but he twisted away before it could drive the weapon up into his guts. He had nowhere to move, and his back was still to the wall. A string of unintelligible screeches emerged from its mandibles, and though its language was utterly alien to Solomon, he could have sworn that the monster was taking pleasure in this struggle. "Come on, then!" he snarled, bracing himself against the rocky side of the crater. The lair coiled its serpentine form beneath it and leapt for him, its arms and claws extended towards him. He leapt to engage it, and the two met with a clash of armoured plate, tumbling to the ground once more. As they fell, Solomon seized one of the lair's glowing arms and smashed his elbow down hard on the junction of the limb and the creature's body. The arm sheared from its body in a spray of stinking blood, and Solomon spun on his heel, driving the energy-sheathed weapon up into its middle. The glowing edge easily tore through the silver armour, and the lair collapsed in a coil of ruptured flesh. A howling shriek burst from its throat as it died, and again Solomon was repulsed by the pleasure he heard in its cry. Disgusted, Solomon threw the lair's severed arm down, the dim glow already fading from the foul weapon. Once again he scrambled up the side of the crater, hauling himself over the lip in time to see his warriors struggling against yet more of the lair as they poured into the plaza. Isolated from the fighting for a moment, Solomon saw that his warriors were trapped, desperately defending against this tide of aliens. His practiced eye saw that without reinforcements there could be no holding it against such numbers. Dozens of Astartes were already down, their bodies twitching as the alien weapons triggered involuntary nerve spasms in their wounded flesh. His sense for the shape of a battle told him that his warriors knew they were on the verge of being overwhelmed, and his collar rose at the thought of these aliens defiling the bodies of the second.
"Children of the Emperor!"
he bellowed, marching from the crater into the lines of fighting Astartes.
"Hold the line! I swore in the fire to First Captain Kayseran that we would capture this place, and we will not be shamed by failing in that oath!"
He saw an almost invisible stiffening of backs and knew that his warriors would not shame him. The second had never yet shown their backs to an enemy, and he did not expect them to now. In ancient times, when warriors had run from battle, their ranks had been decimated, 1 in every 10 warriors beaten to death by their former battle brothers as a bitter warning to the survivors. Such a punishment was, in Solomon's opinion, too lenient. Warriors that ran once would run again, and he was proud that none of his squads had ever needed such a brutal lesson in courage. They took their lead in all things from him, and he would rather die than dishonour his legion with cowardice. The clamour of battle was deafening, and though the line of Emperor's children bent backwards under the onslaught of the Lair, it did not break. Solomon retrieved his bolter from the uneven ground and slid a fresh magazine into the weapon. He moved to the centre of the line and took his place in the thick of the fighting, killing with methodical precision until he ran out of ammunition and switched back to his sword. He fought two-handed, cleaving his blade through alien flesh and bellowing at his warriors to stand firm as a seething tide of Lair surrounded them.